Hackers roll up on him. He pointed at the screen of the dashboard computer where his fellow officers were represented by white numbers on a green screen. Officer Peel is out here today. Peel had knocked that kid's head off, hoodie and all, put handcuffs on the corpse, resisting arrest, no fucking joke. I nodded. I murmured my agreement. I noticed things. The in-car data communication system, I noticed, was called DPSC. Indiana's warrant database system, I noticed, was called IDACS. And it was linked to NCIC, the national system, and to the Marshal Service Fugitive Database System. I watched that Marshal Service scroll for a moment, waiting for Jackdaw's profile to come up until Cook saw me watching. They could reset it, take that feed off of there, he said. But I told him, don't even worry about it. Shit kind of comes in handy, actually. He winked. And I marveled at Officer Cook. Double life, complicated game. He wasn't obligated to have the names and aliases of runners coming up on his screen because black cops were exempt from enforcing the Fugitive Persons Act under the Moore Amendment. But Officer Cook liked having the info so he could push it to his pals in the airlines. He wasn't the only one, and plenty of white officers did the same, and plenty of police chiefs and public safety directors were, if not sympathetic to abolition, at least neutral. One of many reasons why the marshals had more or less stopped relying on local law enforcement. Why they had begun instead to use people like me. Complicated game. Officer Cook moved his gum around in his mouth and tapped his fingers on the wheel. He had a big flat gold ring on one finger catching the sunlight. Class ring. A whole life behind him. So, can I ask you, officer? I let my voice, Dirksen's voice, come out in a reedy tremble. Where exactly are we heading? Monument Circle. Old Abe. I texted Father Barton to meet us. About me? He gave me a look. I told you, man, we gotta play a little smart on this. I told him I got new information on our open case. The kid is stashed just fine for now, but we're working on getting him on a connecting flight. Getting him squared away up in Koh San Luc. He took a stab at the proper French pronunciation, but it sounded silly, and he snorted. Whatever you want to call it, Little America. We've been waiting for word from some folks we work with, some snowmen. And we don't know how they're planning to get in touch, so I told Barton I had news on that front. I nodded. I noticed all the details. Jackdaw's anticipated itinerary, Little America, suburbs of Montreal, a new life. I noticed the offhand status update on him, stashed just fine for now, waiting for a Canadian connection to come through. I knew more than Cook thought I knew. I knew more than he did. I nodded meekly. The wiper blades pushed thin lines of rain off the windshield. I framed my questions with care. So, is that how it works, usually? Get a person settled in the north? That would be for a woman, too? I readjusted my posture in the seat, sat as Dirksen would sit, thinking about his beloved gentle, imagining her in a parka and winter gloves in the snowy reaches of Little America. Yeah, usually, he frowned. Well, I think so. Not my department. Barton handles that part? No, Cook rolled his eyes. Father Barton does a whole lot of nothing most of the time. A lot of speeches. A lot of passing the fucking hat. But other folks do the rescues. Other folks run them north. Other folks sit on them till they're ready to move on them, see? Nobody talks to nobody. I nodded. This was classic underground. Distinct, discontinuous cells. Cutout operations. Everything clean and careful and strictly need to know. The road turned into an overpass spanning a muddy tributary down below, then back into a road with fast food chains and small office buildings slipping past my window. Homeless people on bus stop benches, storefronts available for lease, same thing everywhere, every northern city. And this poor young brother, I said, hushed and hesitant. The one y'all just took, how is he adjusting to his freedom? Cook gritted his teeth, gave his head a quick shake, a passing pain or a reflection of pain. He's a special case, that one. A special kind of kid. Oh, yes? I said. But Cook didn't seem to want to elaborate, and I didn't want to push. We parked downtown across from a tall monument that sat at the center of a traffic circle. It was an imposing white obelisk, topped with a statue of a man in an old-fashioned long coat, standing slender and erect with his arms extended. The man was tall and made taller by his long face and long top hat. And he was surrounded by shorter white columns and tiers of white steps. A 9-foot-tall, bearded, rail-thin white man, stone-faced and stoic, staring out over the downtown, hands out with palms up, as if imploring. Oh, Jesus, I thought, studying the statue. Oh, God. That's right, Indianapolis, Indiana. It was here. This is where they killed the poor bastard. This spot right here is the exact center of the state, Officer Cook was saying, talking over his shoulder as we crossed the circle and approached the man on his high marble pedestal. Indy is smack dab in the middle of Indiana, see? And Monument Circle's the center of the city, and the statue of Old Abe? You get the idea. Plus, of course, the state's in the middle of nowhere, so there you have it. Right now, we're in the exact geographical middle of fucking nowhere. Cook walked briskly up the steps, and I trotted up behind him. Pathetic, desperate little Jim Dirksen, scrabbling and shifting, trailing after tall, striding, confident Officer Willie Cook. He told me that Barton would never get it, because Barton's white. But I knew that Cook would never get it either. A northern man, a black man who had never been a slave. We were like creatures of a different species. I was as different from him as I was from Barton or from Bridge because of what I had seen, because of what moved still beneath my skin. As I thought about it, it came up again, heaving up. And I felt my hand rushing up to my mouth to clamp it shut, keep everything back. The old loud sounds and the stink that always clouded my nostrils, sounds that only I could hear. All I wanted was silence so I could listen to this cocky young officer and gather up the details he was dropping like fruit from a tree. All I wanted was silence. Silence to do my work. What the slave wants but can never have is not only freedom from the chains, but also from their memory. We got to the top of the steps, Cook and me. We stood beside each other looking across the traffic circle at the surrounding storefronts. A sandwich shop, a big pretty Presbyterian church, the entrance to the symphony hall. A couple of friends walked into the Starbucks, a black girl and a white girl, both of them in nurses' scrubs, their arms linked together, giggling. The first thing sun was wavering and uneasy behind a thick bank of clouds. Glimmers of blue making a faint effort around it. I felt the sour acid of anticipation in my gut. I felt the cool mist of rain on my face. "Be a few minutes," said Willie Cook. He tugged out a fresh piece of gum, leaned back on the base of the statue, stuck the dead wad into the foil. A former smoker, traces of old habits in the new. Running around the base of the obelisk was a series of bas-reliefs, starting with Lincoln in knee pants, splitting rails. I wandered slowly around, tracing the lines with my fingers. I remembered it dimly, all the history I had crammed into my head during my wilderness years, my time in Chicago, learning to be human, memorizing the world. It was all here, illustrated in stone, the whole story of Old Abe's assassination, the martyrdom that saved the Union, the murder that remade the country. Here he was, hands raised in humble farewell to the adoring crowd around his train car, the president-elect leaving Springfield for Washington. Here he was on a hotel balcony, eyes wide as he fell backwards from the fatal shot into the arms of his son Robert. Here was Lincoln with a halo, the good angel hovering over the hastily reconvened Congress. Even the members who had thrown down their commissions, who had resigned and stomped off to form the Confederacy in the preceding months, they had returned, moved by the death of a president, wary but willing, ready to start anew. They had found a speech in his pocket, sticky with blood, the address he had planned to give that fateful morning, February 12th, before the pistol shot laid him low. Secretary Seward read it aloud to Congress, and they wept. Even the Confederates wept when Seward got to the words I trace now with my forefinger, words chiseled into the stone at the base of the statue. "I hope that we may meet again under one flag of union." What emerged from that fraught session of Congress in the spring of 1861 was a revised version of Senator Crittenden's complicated compromise, one of the last-ditched failed Union-saving efforts from the year before, seen in fresh light and taken up with fresh energy, while the new Confederate government was suspended, then abandoned. 6 amendments and 4 resolutions, preserving slavery where it was, preventing its extension elsewhere, balancing Northern sentiment and Southern interest, Northern principles and Southern economic welfare. And the clincher, inscribed here in marble as it is inscribed in the Constitution, the 18th Amendment, making the whole rest of them permanent and everlasting, eternal compromise, the great legislative Hail Mary. No future amendment of the Constitution shall affect the 5 preceding articles. I read it in Lincoln's shadow that early morning, and it seemed, as it always did to me, impossible, illegal, childish even, like the child who wishes for infinite wishes. And yet it has worked, so far. It has held. Cook yawned. The nurses came out of the Starbucks, chatting happily, steam rising from their cup lids. I craned my neck and stared up at him, at old Abe, honest Abe, Abraham the martyr. Big hands, palms up, long fingers outstretched. His homely features, solemn and beatified, looking south down Meridian Street. You see how they posed him? Looking down the street? That's where the hotel was. Willie Cook pointed south on Meridian Street, then jerked his handsome face up at old Abe. Poor guy's gonna stand there forever with birds shitting on his head looking at where he got killed. I mustered a hollow laugh, but Officer Cook wasn't paying attention. He was watching the man who was coming now. A powerfully built black man crossing Market Street with his hands jammed in the pockets of gray slacks. All right, murmured Officer Cook. Here we go now. He stood up straight as the man came up the steps toward us. He was very tall and very dark-skinned. Midnight, I calculated automatically, offhandedly. Midnight, purple tone, a number 121 or 122. His eyes were bright and yellow, hidden deep in his head, shifting questioningly back and forth from Cook to me, me to Cook, taking us in. I read the man as muscle, a body man, what was called in airline slang, a baggage handler. I looked down Market to see what kind of car he'd come out of, but wherever he had parked was out of view. Cook raised his hand cheerfully, but the newcomer spoke first. Who is this?
This here's Jim. Jim's new business. Jim, meet Mr. Maris.
Maris nodded at me once, not impolitely, then turned back to Cook, repeating the words new business in mildly accented English. I couldn't tell if he was upset or uncertain of the expression or what. My mind chewed on the accent. African? West African? He wore a cheap blue work shirt with the sleeves rolled up, and he had the thick forearms of a prize fighter. I've known tall men before, but there was something about this Maris's tallness that made you want to turn around and run.
You must spread your legs and raise your arms, Jim.
Cook looked with amusement at me. Soft-bellied Jim Dirksen, then back at Maris. Does he look like he's carrying a gun to you? Maris stepped forward into the shadow of the statue and efficiently ran his big hands over my body.
I am sorry, he said. It is necessary.
I shrugged. Oh, it's okay. I understand. Right as I said it, though, he came out of my back pocket with my butterfly knife, which at the last minute before leaving the hotel I had taken out of my toiletries bag and jammed into my back pocket. Maris held it up to me with a grave expression, then showed it to Cook, who looked at me with eyebrows raised. I blushed, looked down. I thought, sorry, I've been advised to be careful. Cook looked steadily at me for a second, but then he laughed. Maris did not laugh. Wordlessly, he slipped the knife inside his breast pocket, then cocked his head, considering me.
And what of Jim? If anything is known by our favorite.
Maris delivered this inquiry to Officer Cook with a solemn expression, pronouncing the word favorite with three syllables. Favorite. The slight lilt in Maris's voice contrasted pleasantly with the formality of his speaking style, like violet flowers in a rich dark soil. Definitely West African. I wondered if his prints were on file somewhere, if his name or alias was on a watch list. In Bridges Building in Gaithersburg or in Washington at counterterrorism. A Liberian. A friend to the cause.
Oh, he knows.
He knows, said Cook. He smiled at Maris, who did not smile back. Father Sunshine's just being a little particular. You know how he gets. Maris's eyes narrowed and his nostrils flared. His dislike for Officer Cook rose off him like steam.
He does not like to take on new projects until old projects have been completed.
Right, said Cook.
He don't like to, but he will. He's done it before. I don't like to either.
No disrespect, brother, but I could give a shit what you like. Maris glowered. I bore a silent witness, thinking, there is no army of abolition. This is what the world has for heroes. Ordinary men squabbling and prideful, hassling each other, doing their best, busting the world free. And men like me, behind fake papers and clear glass spectacles, keeping it chained. This man's got a woman he loves and nowhere else to turn, said Cook. And the other thing is just about put to bed, right?
No, it is not yet.
A minor hesitation as Maris furrowed his brow, decoding the idiom.
It is not put to bed.
How's he holding up, by the way, said Cook.
Our boy, what's the word from Dr. V?
I kept my eyes blank while I listened to their conversation with radiological intensity. I noticed, how's he holding up? I noticed, Dr. V. I stood silently just behind Officer Cook, noticing things. They were done talking before long, and the three of us stood and waited. Cook leaned on Lincoln's pillow, but Maris crossed his arms and stood erect, his big forearms bulging. He darted out his tongue and licked his lips, and the tip of his tongue was bright pink like a bit of fruit. And then at last came Father Barton in civilian drag, no collar, just a black overcoat and blue jeans, slightly hunched forward, floating like a shadow up the white steps. Maris descended one step, raised his hand to the priest. Barton saw Maris, then he saw Cook. Then Barton saw me, stopped walking, and turned and went back down the steps. "Oh, for fuck's sake," said Officer Cook. Maris hustled down the steps after Father Barton, raising one arm, literally giving Cook and me the back of his hand. "Fuck's sake," Cook called again, and chased after them both. Hey, come on, hey!" I was left at the top step, alone with ugly Abraham Lincoln, with his grim hawk nose and gloomy face, forever president-elect, looking out over his world. Chapter 12. Back in the hotel room, I found a long, spidery crack in the corner behind the rickety desk they give you for writing on, and I sat and stared at the crack for a while, clutching my chest at heart level, holding myself still. I had all these leads. The case was wide open. I had Cook and Maris and their conversation leaky as an old boat. I had a whole wide world to get to. But here all the old stuff was rising up in me like swamp water. The old man and the Franklins and Castle and Mr. Reedy and a swamp full of black-red blood. All of it coming up until the mud filled the back of my throat until I was choking, when I had work to do. Castle. Castle's big eyes in the darkness, so much fucking work to do. With a slow, careful motion, I opened the laptop and turned it on. While it was starting up, I set up my cassette player and put on a mixtape I had. It wasn't all MJ on that one, but quite a lot of it was, and the first song was Ben. Nice and easy, gentle and tender. I let that song work its magic a second, let it cool me out, then I opened my laptop to look for Dr. V. There was no shortage of doctors in Indianapolis, it looked like. It looked, actually, like medicine was one of a handful of bright spots in a dark economic landscape. Like a lot of big Midwestern cities, this one had spent the second half of the 20th century stumbling in and out of recessions, trying to make the best of America's fucked-up piecemeal economy. All that proud but self-defeating unwillingness to do business with the hard four. All the blood and treasure wasted in the Texas War. All the industries from cars to coal to computers that had bloomed and then wilted in the face of international boycotts and sanctions. While, funnily enough, the slave states prospered, protected by the economic insulation of permanently deflated labor costs. Everything's changing in the 21st century, of course, thanks to emerging global markets. Various former communist states and economically insurgent African nations wanting nothing to do with the European consensus, but that tide seemed not yet to have hit Indianapolis. The city, as I saw it from that rickety desk in that cheap hotel room, was a place with a lot of former glories. A used-to-be publishing industry, a used-to-be rail hub, a used-to-be powerhouse in coal and steel. What remained were services. A convention trade, a marketing trade, a handful of technology startups, and healthcare. Lots and lots of healthcare.
Drug companies and medical device companies, ophthalmology centers and optometry centers and cancer centers.
I counted 5 general hospitals, 3 private and 2 public, plus 2 children's hospitals and a vast constellation of outpatient clinics. I sat at the computer listening to my music, drilling deeper in. Within the city's vast population of doctors was a certain number with surnames beginning with the letter V. Within that group was a much smaller group, those with V names long enough or unusual enough to be shorthanded down to Dr. V. I pecked at the keyboard, I typed in instructions. At first I excluded the outlying areas, Carmel, Fishers, Zionsville, Plainfield, but then I re-included them, expanding my lists, narrowing my lists, playing with my lists. I eliminated psychiatrists and psychologists. I eliminated pediatricians and obstetrician-gynecologists. I did not, after some reflection, eliminate dentists or orthodontists. Who could say? I did not know what I was looking for. I was just looking. And meanwhile, I had my map application open and was keeping one eye on it, watching a blue blip move block by block through the city. That was Mr. Maris, still carrying my butterfly knife in his pocket. Embedded in the handle of the knife was a tidy little GPS tracking unit, throwing up location signals to some satellite, which was then throwing them back down to me. I watched Mr. Maris drive south on Meridian Street away from Abraham the Martyr, then cut right on West South Street, then left on Capitol. Planting the bug on Maris was an old trick, an easy one. I'd done 4 months of training after they picked me up in a desert in Arizona before they sent me out on my first file. I'd learned picks and rakes, footprints and fingerprints, fighting and following, database infiltration, encryption and de-encryption. And then after all that, a doctor with no name in a cold room, 2 unconscious hours, the hook, the anchor, the leash. It was funny to think about. Not that funny. Me tracking Maris, Gaithersburg tracking me. MJ was doing everybody's somebody's fool. And I took that as a good sign. I just listened to that a second, just that. Shoobop, shoobop, swelling strings in the chorus. After that, there was a James Brown song, which made me smile. They didn't play a lot of James on the radio. He'd been the leader of one of those god-awful family bands that toured the North in the 50s and 60s. Talented slaves brought North to sing to sold-out Northern audiences, living proof of how happy everybody was down there. But James defected. Snuck out of his Buffalo hotel room and turned up in Quebec City making beautiful music and touring the world. Except for America. "Just look at me," he used to crow from the European concert stages, palming his pompadour, braggadocious in his spangled cape and boots. "Look at what they robbing themselves of." Sort of thing used to happen all the time. There was an Olympic gold medalist from Alabama, a boy named Jesse Owens, who took a mess of world records in Berlin in 1936 and then defected to the Soviet Union. For the next half century, he was one of the evil empire's prized possessions, turning up in Pravda every once in a while to denounce degenerate slave state capitalism. When I felt ready, I got back into it, making notes on Maris's route, jotting it all down, toggling back and forth between his journey and my slow, search-driven encircling of the mysterious Dr. V. After I was satisfied with my initial list of doctors, I closed out the pages full of hospitals and clinics and started opening the donor rolls of every abolitionist organization active in the city and state. There were local organizations called Total Freedom Now, pure abolitionist, and Indie Freedom Works, gradualist. There was a Central Indiana chapter of the Firebell Society, and there was the Indianapolis chapter of the Black Panthers. The membership rolls and the donor lists were all public information except for those of the Panthers, which was officially classified as a terrorist organization, but I got their names by hacking the IMPD. Maris, meanwhile, had gotten on the highway. He moved south by southeast on 465, tracing the city's outskirts. While I watched him, I rehearsed his distinctive African cadence in my mind, replayed what he had said to Cook about the old business. "No, it is not yet. It is not yet put to bed." Seized by an impulse, I said the words out loud, drew myself up to stand at full height as Maris did, making my face solemn as he had. "No, it is not yet," I said to myself, to the computer, to the cracks in the wall. "No, it is not yet put to bed." Then I eased back down into the chair, relaxed my limbs, grinned to show my teeth. What had Cook said, Officer Cook, complicated Cook? "How is he adjusting to his freedom?" I said. And what was the officer's reply? I spoke it in his smooth voice. "He's a special case, that one. Special kind of kid." Then I was myself again. As much myself as I ever was. I popped out of the chair, pulled out the full file pages from their locked box, and read again my favorite part, my least favorite part, the baffling run of words. "Known to have intended to remove himself to Indianapolis." There was something in all of it. What was it? Something buried. In all those bits and scraps scratching to get out. I did the next piece, cross-referenced names with names, circled some and crossed out others. When I was done, I had a list of 4 complicated surnames written carefully in pencil on the hotel notepad. Vasilevsky, Boshansky, Venezia Karbach, and Vishaparatham. 10 minutes later, I was reading a magazine profile 2 years old from a special issue of Indianapolis Monthly celebrating Indy's Unsung Heroes, about a lauded general practitioner who had closed a thriving suburban practice to open a storefront clinic in Hawville, a historic working-class African-American neighborhood north of Freedmantown. This doctor accepted all health plans and dedicated 1/3 of her appointment slots to the uninsured. "Healthcare," declared Dr. Elisabetta Venezia Karbach in the article, "is a basic human right." "All right," I said, toggling back over to my other screen. "All right, all right." Mr. Maris, it seemed, was still on the move. His blue dot had come off the highway on the Near East Side. I watched him cruise 42nd Street past the fairgrounds, then turn right to come south on Keystone. I was still watching him while the phone rang, but then when Dr. Venezia Carvox's receptionist answered, I stood up and found my voice, said, "Yes, ma'am, how are you, sweetheart?" A little growly and weary, a cough in the back of my throat, a man in need of a doctor. "My name," I said, "was Kenny Morton." Sliding open the balcony doors now, staring again at the parking lot, and yes, I would be a new patient, that's right, ma'am, and no, ma'am, I had no health insurance at this time, and I had to confess, I was of limited means, but if there was some way I could, yes, tomorrow morning would be fine, Saturday, right, I know, that'll do for me just fine, and oh my, thank you so much, that's just wonderful, ma'am, and I really do appreciate it so much, and thank you. And while I turned in this small workmanlike performance, leaning into the balcony threshold, growling over the phone, I could see the memories coming for me, swelling over the horizon, charging across the parking lot between the cars like bloody horses.
"There he is, mystery man, my savior."
She was out of her jean jacket, and she changed into some sort of short-sleeved dress, but the Doc Martens were still on. She had winding tattoos, dark ink on the strawberry flesh of her calves, summer flowers, peonies, and roses. Her boy was in a bathing suit with a Spider-Man towel slung over his shoulder. The white girl fell into step beside me, walking down the second-floor hallway with the boy trailing behind.
"I'm Martha, by the way."
"How do you do? I'm Jim Dirksen."
"Oh, okay. Jim Dirksen, sorry. I didn't know we were doing last names."
She was in her late 20s, early 30s, but she was tiny and laughed like a teenager, big and unselfconscious.
"Martha Flowers, and this here's Lionel, like the trains."
"Mama," the kid scowled and bumped into his mom accidentally on purpose.
"Like the lion."
Martha rolled her eyes.
"Do you know that cartoon, Lionel the Lion?
It's terrible."
"It's, no, it's not, Mama," said Lionel. "It's badass."
"Whoa, hey,"
Martha playfully shocked, knocking her son gently on his shoulder.
"Don't say badass. You say it. I'm allowed to say it."
I smiled at all this, the teasing and admonishment, the affectionate banter. I had learned about the love between parents and children the way I had learned so many other things, by observation, by skulking, by paying attention through what I came to call, in retrospect, my shadow years. Years out of slavery but not yet in civilization. Saving up to buy solid papers, living underground in Naperville in a church basement, under a train bridge on Chicago's west side. I'd spend whole days in the reading room of the big library downtown, a shadow in the corner, reading the great slave narratives, reading Ellison, Baldwin, Wright, learning my own history. I read Zora Neale Hurston's masterpiece, the one that had legendarily been smuggled page by page out of a Florida cane plantation 2 decades before that state went free. Slowly drinking water in coffee shops, perching on corners, watching people interact, learning free American language. The way people laughed when they were allowed to laugh out loud. "Ha, ha, ha," I said to myself on the basement floor in the middle of the night. "Ha, ha, ha." The elevator door binged.
"Well, come on, Jim Dirksen,"
said Martha.
"Come on down to the pool and chat a minute."
It wasn't much of a pool they had down there, 50 square feet maybe. A shallow end and a deep end and no diving board or anything. A list of rules painted on a wooden sign. No diving, no horseplay, no lifeguard on duty. At the far end of the room was a glass wall revealing the fitness center, a couple treadmills and a bowl of fruit and a wall-mounted TV set to CNN. Lionel dropped his towel and leaped unceremoniously into the pool, cannonballing in, disappearing, and then splashing back up a second later, sputtering and grinning, water dew-dropping on his brow.
"Oh, my God," he shouted. "It's so cold, Mama. You gotta come in. It's so cold."
"No way."
"Come on. I didn't even wear a suit."
Lionel blew her a raspberry and wheeled back under the surface, flashed around, a streak beneath the chlorine blue. A second later, his feet jutted up from the surface and kicked back and forth.
"Kid's amazing,"
said Martha softly, then abruptly.
"Thanks for the food yesterday morning, by the way. Very decent of you. Extremely human."
I shrugged. "How was the job fair?"
"Great,"
she pushed at her hair.
"Really great. Really, really, really great."
She smiled sardonically, but her eyes were anxious and scared, staring into some kind of bad future.
"It was the sort of thing, the first day is all applications, meeting the people. Then people call you back on the second day if they want you to come in and interview.
I remembered the stack of paperwork on her lap, dog-eared photocopies, ballpoint pens smearing everywhere.
So, you know, anyway,
she said,
here I am at the pool.
Well, I had my own thing going. I had my own problems. A clutch of new kids came in, white kids shrieking. A girl, maybe 13, plus two twin brothers just about Lionel's age, the girl with freckles and the boys with flat Midwestern crew cuts. They all splashed on in there, and the boys immediately got into some kind of tussle with Lionel, the way kids that age do, making themselves into animals, sliding around each other, surfacing on each other's shoulders.
So what's your story?
Martha asked me, and I lingered, polite as Dirksen was polite.
Business or pleasure? I'm going to guess business.
Why do you guess that?
Oh, well, you know, a gentleman traveling alone in Indianapolis. It's a nice town, but it's not like, I don't know.
She laughed.
Cancun, right?
Right, I smiled. Yes, I travel quite a lot for business. As soon as I said it, I wished I had held my tongue. It was a foolish thing to say, unnecessary. Martha was interested, too.
Cool,
she said.
God, I wish I traveled a lot. What do you do? Why are you here?
I work for a company called Sulawesi Digital as a site analyst. She blinked. I smiled. It's a cellular service provider based in Indonesia.
What was it? Sula... What was it?
Right, well, I smiled. Apologetic site analyst smile. See, that's what we're working on changing. The company's wanting to start opening some American locations, raise brand awareness. So I've been traveling to some cities, investigating available retail properties and storefronts and shopping centers, and then what I'll do is submit an analysis to Jakarta as to the relative desirability of each potential location. I had delivered this short speech with the same dull, Dirksonian earnestness 10 or 12 times in the past. Most people, you could watch them glaze over the minute you said words like analyst, words like relative desirability. But this girl, this Martha, her eyes were open to the story. She was nodding with fascination as if I'd announced that I was a contract killer. She even asked a follow-up question. Asked what makes a location suitable or unsuitable. And I gave her the combination of factors. Pedestrian traffic, neighborhood demographics, competition. While Lionel shrieked and giggled with his new friends. I could keep this up all day if she wanted to. My identity was researched, backed up, backstopped, and double backstopped. Martha sighed.
I've been to, like, Vincennes. That's my world travels.
Her eyes were far away.
What's the best place you've ever been?
Best?
Yeah, best. You know, most interesting?
Bell's Farm. Bell's Farm was interesting. Chicago, I said.
Oh, Chicago. I would love to go to Chicago. Have you been there a lot?
My throat felt rusty. The room breathed chlorine. How long had it been since I spoke to anyone this way? I lived there for some time. Lakeshore Drive, the first time. Skyscrapers lordly and glass-walled, hovering magisterially above Lake Michigan, reflecting gloriously at one another. My astonishing, terrifying sentinels of liberty.
I've never been,
Martha said. Her shoes were off. Her toes were in the water. Among her tattoos were twin butterflies, one on each ankle, perfectly symmetrical, I noticed. I notice everything.
You believe that? I've lived in Indiana my whole life. I even lived in Gary for 6 months once, and I never got up there.
That does seem like a shame.
You're telling me.
She closed her eyes, like she was picturing it. Picturing herself in Chicago. I pictured myself there, too, eating a hot dog. I pictured Castle. I opened my eyes again.
I don't know,
Martha was saying.
I never got hold of the right weekend, I guess. And then the kid happened, and, well, you don't have kids, huh?
No, ma'am.
Well, they're great.
She leaned into me, gave me a big stage whisper.
But they fuck everything up.
Martha laughed, and her eyes found her boy, goofing around with these white kids, trying to dunk one under, his sleek body spangled with droplets. Another woman had come in, meanwhile. A middle-aged white lady in a black bathing suit, freckle-specked cleavage and sandy hair and big Midwestern arms with a towel wrapped around her waist. She took a look at us, at me and Martha sitting there talking. Then she looked at the pool.
Watch this,
Martha said.
Just watch.
What?
Just watch.
But I knew. I knew what Martha knew. The woman put her hands on her hips. We knew what was coming. Even Jim Dirksen knew. Marcus, Dylan, Jamie, The woman waved her kids in like a lifeguard when there was a shark. Time for lunch!
What?
Squealed one of the white children.
We just got here,
said another. The boys treaded water, their freckled faces twisted at the injustice. Lionel bobbed beside them. The teen sitting on the pool steps wrinkled her nose.
I thought we were going to swim first.
Nope, said the mom.
After. Come on. Now.
The family climbed out, and the woman towed them off and hustled them out. Lionel was left alone, treading water. A solitary buoy. Martha raised both middle fingers and pointed them at the lady like guns. We heard the children, their complaining voices growing dimmer as they disappeared down the corridor. Lionel went under and then came up, crested the blue surface with a harvest of sparkling droplets across his curls, his mouth a small, disappointed line, watching the other kids trudge away.
Do we have to go too?
He said softly.
No, sweetness. We're good. You're good. I'm just chatting with Mr. God, I forgot it.
Dirksen, I said quietly.
Right, right. It's a nice name.
Thanks, I muttered it, murmured it. I didn't know where the name Dirksen came from. It came from Bridge or from Bridge's people. It probably came from a Gaithersburg phone book. Martha was still talking small talk, talking about the Batlish hearings.
Have you been watching my girl Donatella, by the way, squaring off up there? She is my hero.
Well, anyway, I said suddenly and stood up. Anyway, I was walking fast. Behind me, I heard Martha saying, Jim, and the boy, too. I heard him calling after me from the water's edge, giving me back the word I gave him.
Controversy!
But I was gone. Chapter 13. Day 3 of the investigation and possibilities were fanned out in front of me like playing cards. At some point, Cook would make contact with me again, or maybe I with him. I had his car number, after all, and his badge number. I had his face emblazoned in my mind, a row of white teeth and a wink and a smirk. I had an appointment for tomorrow morning, the first available slot, with the famous Dr. V. And there was Mr. Maris, freedom fighter, soldier, a blip on my screen, a man on the move. I drove with my laptop open on the shotgun seat, so as I cruised the city, I could watch him cruising it, too. At some point, he'd stop his car, and maybe that would just be that. Maybe Maris was the body man, the baggage handler, and I would go where he was, and there would be the boy. Get this done. Get out of here. On to some other northern city. Whole Wide World Logistics was in an office park off Binford Boulevard in an industrial section of the northeastern part of the city. One in a row of identically unimpressive gray storefronts lined up like prisoners, with smudged plate glass windows and doors of streaky glass. Across the parking lot, casting its vast shadow over this dingy arrangement, was a massive converted warehouse painted with bright jungle murals and a cheerful cartoon sign. Come and play in Indy's biggest indoor trampoline park. I got out of the Altima already working, crossing the lot in a hustle with my face anxious and my body tense. A rush of noise washed over me from behind my back, a laugh and a delighted squeal, and the celebratory ding-ding-ding of an arcade game. Someone had opened the door of the trampoline park, let its noise filter out across the parking lot from a universe away. I pushed into Whole Wide World and got right to work, thinking, here we go, breathing hard, saying, hey, I'm sorry, hey, as the door made its little bing-bong noise and eased closed behind me. The woman behind the long counter was looking at me, already skeptical. She checked me out, and I checked out the room, the tottering stacks of papers and file folders all along the counter, the window, letting in smudged sallow light, the tile floor in need of a sweep and a mop. High on the wall was a row of clocks, Manila and Mumbai, San Francisco and Paris, distant cities, foreign lands. Under the clocks was the globe logo I'd seen in the picture, purple and green and radiating lines of speed. Closest to the door was a giant dry erase board cluttered with handwriting, different colors, a crosshatch of numbers, dates, account numbers, and order numbers. And in the lower left-hand corner, a little purple heart and the words, Dear Day Shift, have a great day. Love, Night Shift.
Yes?
The Day Shift was a middle-aged, round-cheeked black woman, a glossy magazine open on the counter in front of her.
Yeah, hey,
I said, talking quickly, slightly out of breath.
Winston around?
Nope, she said.
He's sick.
Sick?
Yeah, he called in.
Sick. Could that just be coincidence? Just bad luck? Or had my man Winston smelled something coming?
This woman, meanwhile, was looking at me, fingering the pages of her magazine, waiting for me to split. I could appreciate that. I was back in Albie's rumpled gardener's outfit, stained grass green at the knees, bits of soil clinging to the cuffs. I was putting on a full show here, huffing and puffing, wiping sweat off my brow, drumming my fingers on the counter.
Just my luck, boy. Sick. Boy, whoo!
Yes, she shrugged. Obviously, she was supposed to say, can I help you with something? But it was equally obvious that she did not want to help me. Do you want to leave him a message?
Nah, I said. No thanks.
Still, I didn't leave. She cast a longing glance at her magazine. Thin white celebrities in swimsuits lying like famine victims on a scorched beach. Winston Bibbs' colleague was dark-eyed and plumpish, her hair elaborately woven, her forehead high and gleaming under the fluorescence. Her skin was coffee, light-toned, in the number 120 range. I did this evaluation by reflex, then found that just doing that quick calculation for some reason made me sick. My stomach rolled. This here was a free woman, after all, a northern woman, a vested citizen. What right had I to look at her that way, to size her up, mark her down for a Gaithersburg file?
Well,
she said, poor girl, I'd given her no choice. Maybe I can help.
Oh, I don't know, I hope so, I don't know, I really don't know.
At last she closed her magazine and looked straight on at my face and her expression softened. I saw it happen, and I doubled down. I tilted my head a certain way I had and I grinned a soft grin of mine, narrowed my eyes in a way that I knew put light in them and crinkles at the corners.
My name's Angie, by the way. She slipped the magazine under the counter. Tell me what you need.
Okay, well, I said, it's a little complicated. For Angie, I rolled out a long story, one with several twists and turns in it. My boy Sully, see, had gotten me a gig not two dang weeks ago driving a light truck just around the city. Nothing long haul, nothing complicated. 'Cause, you know, I just last year got my CDL, see, and Sully'd hooked me up, man, a nice gig driving for this garden supply place, loading a pickup with different kinds of supplies, you know, mulch, topsoil, garden rocks. I ticked it off on my fingers, all that kind of shit.
Sorry, Angie, that kind of stuff. She smiled, waved it off. Go on.
Part of the gig was to meet up with the long hauls coming from out of town, help them unload at the company warehouse down there off Troy Avenue. Angie nodded, sure. Her cousin Addie, as it turned out, lived near there, near Troy Avenue.
Oh, yeah? I said. No kidding.
The warehouse address I'd pulled off my mapping software. Everything else was pure spun sugar, a song I was singing, finding the tune as I went. I talked as quickly as I could, gesturing a lot, charging my voice with exasperation. Angie was nodding, magazine forgotten. On the clock above her head, it became midnight in Abu Dhabi. Anyway, I went on. Easy gig, just load it up, drop it off, nothing to it, you know? When I said that, I gave Angie a smart look, like, yeah, right, there's always more to it, whatever it is. And she returned the look with a smart one of her own, shaking her head, yeah, right. Angie and me, we were no dummies. We knew the score.
Oh, hey, look at that, I announced suddenly. Loving those nails.
She beamed, held them up. This stray compliment was just icing, just a little conversational texture. Although I did mean it sincerely. Each fingernail was painted a different color, and together they formed a sparkling 10-finger rainbow across the faded yellow of the countertop. She spread her fingers for further inspection, which I supplied, whistling admiringly before getting to the heart of the matter. But so Monday morning, Sully tells me about a job. Truck left the supplier sometime Sunday night, and now I'm supposed to go and do the pickup at a vacant lot on 12th Street, maybe 2 miles past the speedway, almost out in Hendricks. Paperwork ain't come in yet, he says, but I better get moving. 2 barrels of pit-run gravel, 2 cubic yards to the barrel, we're talking like a couple tons of shit. Sorry, Angie, there I go again. Angie cased my hand for a wedding ring when she thought I wasn't looking. But so I pulled up the light truck Monday morning to this lot, and guess what?
No rocks, said Angie.
I slapped the counter. No rocks, you believe that?
She shook her head, she clucked her tongue.
The old boy messed you up.
That's right. I tugged out my handkerchief and wiped my forehead, laying it on thick for sure at this point. But sometimes this is how you gotta do it. You make yourself an open face of need, you send out need like smoke signals. You let need billow out and fill up the room. Because now the boss, I said, Sully's boss, Mr. Coleman, who is now my boss, he's saying this is on me.
He's saying, I better find out what happened to that shipment or it's coming out of my check.
Angie guffawed, incredulous.
And you haven't even been paid yet.
That's right. I slapped the counter again, both hands this time.
That's right.
Angie smiled. I smiled. We smiled at each other.
So I've been going crazy. This is 4 days now, I said. All Sully knows is the name of the supplier, and I called them. Can't get a straight answer. Sully does not know the name of the truck company. Between you and me, Angie, my man Sully, we're not talking about Albert Einstein here, all right?
I'm getting that.
So I've been going around to different shippers, you know, because I got to figure this out or I ain't even getting my first paycheck. I'm supposed to be Sherlock Holmes or something. I'm the dang pea gravel police all of a sudden.
Angie laughed. I laughed. We laughed with each other.
You got a packing slip number, she said, coming down off the laughter.
No.
Client account number?
No.
Like I told you.
You got nothing?
Zip.
I leaned forward on the counter, let my golden eyes brim with need. I pushed the cap back so she could see my whole sad, handsome face. I was a weary and sorry soul, but nice to look at. I knew exactly how I looked.
Well, let's see, said Angie.
And then, bless her beautiful free heart, she turned to her computer.
So, Sunday, she said and started typing. What's the name of the place?
Okay, now, that's another little problem. Angie reared her head back and clucked, gave me a look.
Are you serious?
I grinned. Sheepish.
It's garden something, I said. I know that. Garden store, gardens of, I don't know, garden something.
And you know where it's coming from?
Of course you don't. Alabama, maybe?
Angie gave me a different kind of look, sharp and serious, angry even.
Not Alabama. Not with us. We do south-south, and we do north-north. We do a little bit of north-to-south, but we usually contract those out. We do zero south to north. You want south to north, you need a specialty shipper to make sure you're clearing all the regulations and whatnot. Most SN places, they only do SN, because the other customers, they do not want to be dealing with that shit.
Angie did not apologize for the word.
Best believe I would not be sitting here shipping south to north.
Oh, right. Right.
Best believe it.
Angie clucked. The very idea. Meanwhile, I was processing this. I had assumed, and Bridge had assumed along with me, that Barton had chosen Winston Bibb to blackmail because Whole Wide World could arrange a truck to go all the way, to bring Jackdaw from GGSI up to Indy. But this company didn't move shipments north out of the four. Angie was leaving little doubt about that. She was back to the computer, still shaking her head, typing rapidly without breaking her masterpiece fingernails.
So look, she said. I can just look for shipments starting with garden, that's all. Anything coming out anywhere, Sunday afternoon, starting with garden, I can do that.
You can do that?
Oh, baby, there's a lot of things I can do.
Totally deadpan. Just the tiniest shadow of a smile, not even looking up from the screen.
Don't tease me now, Angie, I said. Don't you mess with me.
Angie typed a while, then told me to give her just a second more, and I did. I drummed on her counter with my fingertips and flashed her sweet smiles, pulsing with anxiety and flirtatious energy, while inside I thought with a certain indistinct longing of the kids in the indoor trampoline park on the other side of the parking lot. White kids and black kids hurling themselves up and down, up and down. I pictured them in slow motion, smiling from ear to ear, howling their glee.
Here, said Angie. Here we go.
She turned the screen so I could see, and I slapped the counter one last time, loud and hard enough to make the dry erase board shiver on the wall and the little bell above the door ring.
Oh, Angie, I said. Oh, Angie!
She leaned back in her chair.
You just tell your man Sully I said not to be jerking you around again.
I surely will, Angie. I surely will. She beamed. A nice girl like Angie, she tangled with a Sully or two in her day.
Hey, listen, I said at last. You think you could print this screen out for me?
Chapter 14. Only very rarely is there a real plane involved. Every once in a while you hear about some damn fool thing, some billionaire thinks he's God, hires a daredevil pilot to swoop into the airspace of the four, land hard and dark in a clear-cut Alabama hollow, try and get back with a hold full of refugees. Never ends well. A plane is big and hard to hide. And defending the sovereign airspace of the several states is an enumerated responsibility of the Air National Guard. Rich boy ends up in court and the pilot in jail. Peeps go back where they came from, if they're lucky. No, man. Underground Airlines is a figure of speech. It's the root of a grand extended metaphor. Pilots and stewards and baggage handlers and gate agents. Connecting flights and airport security. The airlines flies on the ground in package trucks and unmarked vans and stolen tractor trailers. It flies in the illicit adjustment of numbers on packing slips, in the suborning of plantation guards and the bribing of border security agents, in the small arts of persuasion, by threat or cashier's check or blowjob. The airlines is orders placed by imaginary corporations for unneeded items to be shipped to such and such a place at such and such a time. Once, for a month or more, I was Jean-Claude Six, a.k.a. Café au Lait, a Montreal-born mulatto and a member of a French-Canadian biker gang called Les Bénévoles Blackburn, which specializes in transporting runaways from their temporary and dangerous quarters in northern cities to La Vraie Liberté in Côte-Saint-Luc. Among that crew was a woman named Cherie, who had herself escaped from Louisiana and then dedicated her adult life to the cause. Most of their work, Cherie liked to say, was done at a desk. Forget the glory of the pre-dawn raid. Smashing in the face of the system and pulling free the enslaved was mostly a matter of paperwork. The opening of bank accounts, the forging of documents, the creation of routes and backups to the backups. La liberté, Cherie was fond of saying, in that charming Montreal accent of hers, est en question du logistique. Freedom is a matter of logistics. The other thing to remember, of course, is that most people get no help at all. I sure didn't, oh no. It was just me and Castle, charging, desperate through the country darkness. And that's how it is for most folks who dare to run. No help from no airlines, no help from no one. They just go, man. After years of planning or in the heat of a sudden moment, they go. Hurl their skinny bodies over a cyclone fence or plunge themselves into a moat. Break free of a chain line or a guard's hard grip and run, brother, run, sister. Run along back roads and through forests. No planes and no cars or trucks either. Just brave souls darting across open fields and wading in and out of rivers and stumbling along deer paths through dark woods. Find the star and follow it, as runners have done all the way back to the days of old slavery. I was turning all this over. I was turning over the whole world. I was sitting in a restaurant called Hamburger Stand, a chain place that got all over Indianapolis, waiting for my waitress to bring me coffee. I was staring with glass eyes through the window, looking at the restaurant parking lot where a grimy old white dude in a knitted cap was slumped against the curb, dressed in black garbage bags, with another black garbage bag draped across his body like a blanket. Nothing I hadn't seen 1,000 times before, every poor city, every northern city. But it hit me this time as bizarre somehow. A human body just lying there like that, people stepping past him on their way to Keystone Avenue as though he were a corpse. The lady brought me my coffee and I asked her for a hamburger. Then I turned my eyes down to the document that had come off Angie's printer. Row 6 showed a delivery leaving from Gardens of Paradise in Clayton, Ohio. And Angie had highlighted it in bright pink because that's the shipment poor Rattled Albie was after. But me, down there inside Albie's skin, my interest was in row 7, the next one down in the alphabetical list. The shipment that had left Garments of the Greater South Incorporated in Pine Woods, Alabama, at 8:49 on Sunday night. According to the full file, Jackdaw had fetched up in worker care at 8:35. And now here was a truck put into motion by Winston Bibb to rattle out of the gates of shipping and receiving at 8:49. I traced the row from left to right. I moved my finger slowly across it, like a man reading a Bible verse. Memorized the numbers and the facts the numbers represented. And then I dragged my finger back over and did it again. The shipment bore internal identifier number 49-09-5442. The hauling vehicle was a 45-foot semi-trailer pulled by a mid-roof tractor unit, VIN number 6ZRFL16222CJ287765. Behind the wheel was driver number HR59. The truck was bound for Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, laden with 4,200 raw bolts for export, along with 6 tons miscellaneous supply/waste, and 26 pallets of cotton t-shirts, 40 boxes to the pallet, 75 shirts to a box. That made 78,000 t-shirts plus, I was now sure, I was pretty goddamn sure, one brave, scared, sick, and desperate man.
One human being tacked in there among all the numbers. La liberté est une question de logistique.
I looked at the sidewalk again. The old man shifting around, people walking past in and out of the parking lot. Wherever I looked in this city, all I saw was parking lots. That's what it felt like anyway. Bleached sidewalks and a grim sunless horizon. Something about this job was washing out the world, taking the weather out of the sky. Jackdaw left GGSI at 8:49 on a tractor trailer bound for Hartsfield Airport. Pine Woods to Hartsfield, south to south. Georgia abolished slavery by statute in the year 1944, same as Kentucky. It was President Truman's great victory, achieved by dangling the prize of wartime contracts, a huge economic incentive for states to go free. But the Georgia legislature, in its wisdom and under pressure from Alabama and the newly united state of Carolina, had kept its airport quasi-southern, half slave and half free. The same with the Red Highway, U.S. Highway 20, like an open wound east to west across the state, keeping its neighbors connected to its airport and to the international market for cotton and cattle and corn. According to the very last column on the chart, all those cotton t-shirts were bound ultimately for Shanghai Pudong International Airport. But Jackdaw hadn't been flown to China, had he? He was here. He was known to have intended to remove himself to Indianapolis, right? When the girl brought my hamburger, I murmured, "Thank you," and ate it slowly, purposefully enjoying each bite as I had trained myself to enjoy such things. I chewed and swallowed and cleaned my chin with my napkin, not thinking about the smells and sights of my childhood, imagining Jackdaw as a blue dot moving east and not as a man, folded up inside a 45-foot trailer dying from having to piss, his delicate face wilting and sweat-soaked, his eyes big in the darkness of whatever box or pallet he was crated up in. What was he thinking about? Did he know how he was going to get from there to here? Had Barton's proxies briefed him on the plan, or had he simply cast his lot with strangers? Was he just waiting to find out what would happen to him as I was waiting to find out now? When I was done with the burger, I pushed away my plate. I kept on staring at the printout from Whole Wide World, but all that was left to be discovered was on the back, where Angie had drawn a smiley face and her phone number in pink highlighter. In the car, I turned on my laptop and saw right away that Mr. Maris was no longer driving around. The dot, which had been making Pac-Man patterns around the map of the city, had now settled on 30th Street, a mile and a half past Keystone. Maybe Maris had realized he was still carrying around old Jim's butterfly knife and tossed the thing out the window. Or maybe he was there now with Jackdaw the slave, and all my searching and cross-checking were moot, and all I had to do was go and scoop him up. Chapter 15. When I got there, though, there was no sign of Mr. Maris. I got out of the Altima at the address the map had given me, in yet another gray parking lot on East 30th Street. This lot was little more than a widening of the road shoulder, an oval of rough gravel with parking spaces haphazardly painted on. The businesses arranged around the lot, all apparently part of the same fiefdom, were of a ramshackle third-world quality. There was Slim's Market, an unpainted small building, wide and low as a log cabin, the front door propped open with a phone book, a few rows of fruit and vegetable bins haphazardly arrayed outside on staggered wooden platforms. Opposite the market was Slim's Garage, an auto body shop with its doorway nearly obscured by a half-dozen teetering columns of tires. And then there was a rickety, unsanded picnic table, and behind the picnic table was a flimsy copper archway, hammered into the dirt like a croquet wicket at the head of a rough path winding down into the woods. Following this path, said the sign, would take you to Slim's Trailer Court. No Maris. No sign of Maris. No sign of anyone. Mine was the only car in the lot. I opened the shotgun door and checked my laptop again. Lo and behold, the dot had disappeared, and no new location was being shown. Mr. Maris had dropped clean off the map. God damn it, I said out loud. I looked around. Fuck! A single bird, small and dark-winged, lit on the copper arch and then flitted away again. I walked a few paces on the dirt path down toward the trailer park until I could make out the shapes of the parked RVs and Winnebagos shadowy under the bare trees. There were a dozen or more down there, ringed around a bank of water hookups. Most were up on concrete blocks, the wheels long gone, trailer homes more than trailer. The whole scene had a quiet, dirty beauty. The pockmarked gravel lane between these tin can houses, the cheap clothes hung up to air dry in the chill air. Behind the cluster of RVs was a leaky twist of muddy brown water flowing tiredly out of a drainage pipe that emerged from a shallow hill. More than one of the campers was festooned with a red pennant, and these identical fluttering flags had numbers on them. I looked closer, peered in the dusk gloom. Four red numbers on a white background. 18.